Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked. I'm your shelf-obsessed book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and this week we're in South East London, visiting someone who, with apologies to E.B. White, is a true friend and a good writer. It's the novelist, columnist and podcaster Caroline O'Donoghue. Caroline's debut, Promising Young Women, is the deliciously dark story of Jane, the talented advertising ingenue who falls for a man who might not be all that he seems. Is he a regular bad guy or the sort of bad guy who gets dreamed up at a Hammer horror script meeting? Caroline is a contributing editor for The Pool, the smart women's website loved by millions of readers. She writes a weekly column for the Irish Times and she hosts two fabulous podcasts, School for Dumb Women and her newly launched series about classic pieces of women's commercial fiction, Sentimental Garbage. We met Caroline just before Christmas, so this episode has a bit of an end-of-term vibe, especially because we were very excited to hang out with Sylvie the dog.
Hello, that's a bobble off my Christmas tree.
we're recording this in December, not to time it too intently, but we've got dogs, we've got Christmas, it's all good.
There's
here.
Some cider mulling over there.
It does smell amazing, that Thank cider. You. Very spicy. Oh, so that Delia Ephron book, is she any relation?
She is Nora Ephron's sister.
Oh my god. I had no idea. Tell me.
Oh my goodness. So Delia Ephron is Nora Ephron's younger sister, and in Hanging Up, which was later made into a movie with Meg Ryan, Lisa Kudrow, and Diane Keaton, and yet somehow is a film that no one knows about.
Whoa.
It's actually a brilliant, brilliant book. Like, do you know how when you read Nora Ephron and you love her, but you also feel like she'd eat you alive? Like, you feel like you'd love to go to lunch with Nora Ephron, but on the proviso that you already knew that she loved you and you wouldn't want to chance her not liking you because she said something terrible about your hair or whatever. Delia is kind of the softer, like, person who might actually pick you up from the bus station at 2 a.m. version of Nora Ephron. It's like she just wants to please everyone and loves everyone and she loves her dog. And in Hanging Up, it is about three sisters. You're going away with that today. It's about three sisters who, and their father is dying and their mother is already dead. And they're just basically calling each other. It's all in phone calls, the entire book. And it's them calling each other about who's going to take dad this weekend and who's going to do this and who's shirking their responsibility. And there is a brilliant character that is basically Nora, of my older sister who runs a magazine in New York and is always too busy and is always stealing my jokes. And she wrote my chicken stuffing recipe as her own in her magazine, and she put herself on the cover of her own magazine. It's basically a hilarious satire of what is like being Nora's younger sister. I love it. It also has one of my favourite lines ever. I give away so many books, but that one I actually refer to a lot because there's a bit that she says whenever I feel like I'm being an asshole for gossiping about people. She says, gossip is just the way that we learn how other people process things. Do you know what I mean?
Oh my God, that makes so much sense.
Right? It's like, you know, when you're like, because when I'm discussing a woman that, let's face it, the only interesting gossip is about other women. When I'm discussing a woman, it's like, I'm like, why has she done that now? Why did she get with him even though she's clearly not over him? Why is she doing that? Why? I'm always just trying to pick apart why that woman is doing something.
All we're trying to do is to understand other people's desires and motivations.
Right? Like, to gossip is to be a writer, right?
It's to be a writer, to be an unreliable narrator. Yeah. The bits you hone in on, the details. You know when you're sort of, I'm quite embarrassed that I've never heard of this, but although I'm so excited to read it.
She is not that
like, the rest
famous.
Of the podcast is just going to be me going,
No, do take it.
Because I really love Nora Ephron writing about jealousy and her, I think it's a review she's written of a memoir of Dorothy Parker, and she talks about her own Dorothy Parker complex and when she
yes.
came to New York to be a writer, in the way that I think so many of us have a Nora Ephron complex.
Well, you sent that extract to me the other day and I'd never read it before, and it was in response to, because I wrote this piece about romance fiction and about how if any woman is doing any kind of writing about women's lives that is commercial. Sorry, that's my dog. Hi,
Sil. She's really getting up there.
I'm very sorry. She's in the heat at the moment, so she's quite pungent and
very
looking
strange. God, maybe it's me. Sylvia has a sapphic side.
She is quite sapphic. Yeah, I mean, she's got the shoulders for it. So. the new Nora Ephron, the new Bridget Jones, and it's like, it's great the first time you hear it, but then you see all of your peers who get called the same thing and you're like, oh, this actually means nothing. To be called the new Nora Ephron just means for a man to say, or a person who doesn't generally like the genre you work in, to say, oh, this is kind of facile and about women's lives, but don't worry, it's actually kind of okay. You know,
I am excited to see a really beautiful copy of Rebecca, which is normally, it's far too highbrow for it to be the kind of book that would catch my eye. It's the 80th anniversary edition. It's gorgeous. Oh, and Sarah Perry wrote the introduction.
She did.
But I am a big fan of your podcast, Sentimental Garbage, about commercial women's fiction and the titles we've fallen in love with. And I've noticed you do keep coming back to Rebecca.
Oh my God, I was so embarrassed by that. I wanted my producer, Hannah, to get cut it out because I was like, oh my, I'm like those people.
Everything, it's the new Rebecca.
I know. We've had two episodes so far. One about Marion Keyes and one about Eva Rice, and I managed to reference Rebecca and Daphne du Maurier in both of them, and I feel very embarrassed. I feel like those teenagers on the internet who think everything is Harry Potter. But I just love Rebecca, and do you know what? I came to Daphne du Maurier relatively, I don't know, late, about maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And it was one of those kind of splurges where I started with Rebecca, went on to My Cousin Rachel, went on to Jamaica Inn, and just like read most of her novels in a summer. And then obviously everything I wrote sounded a bit like I was trying to be Daphne du Maurier.
Oh, but I wonder about that a lot with stealing, because that's something that's come up a bit. And do you think, is she your most stolen voice, do you think, as a writer? Have you managed to shake it off?
I don't know. I do think that Promise to Young Women, which is my debut novel that came out in June, that there is a sort of a, you know how like Daphne loves big houses and like rambling rooms and going into different wings of different places,
that sort of sense of the gothic,
that sort of sense, yeah. I feel like in my book there's a bit of like that happens, but in a big advertising agency in Soho. It's like she's always rambling into different rooms and they're kind of always closing in on her and stuff, and I feel like I wanted to bring a little bit of the gothic house narrative but to an everyday workplace. I don't know if I succeeded.
I think that's amazing.
Because yeah, like because our homes aren't what they used to be. You know what I mean? Do you know, like back in the sort of 20th century when people spent their whole lives, you know, their whole day in the one place, and that place took on sort of spiritual meaning and it grew its own personality. But we don't spend as much time in our own houses. We spend them at work. And so those places take on their own meaning and their own spirit, you know.
So true. We're millennials. The housing market does not support our need for space to ramble in. What fictional house, rather, would you most like to squat in, given the chance?
Oh my goodness! Do you know what I just finished? And it's not here because I had it on audiobook. Do you know Brother of the More Famous Jack?
Yes, Barbara Tripido. I love.
Oh my God! I just finished it, and it was heaven. like this. So it's like this sort of academic Jewish English family living in Sussex, and
yes, that's it. And they've got this sort of bucolic wonderland. And I can't remember what wife's called, but she's always sort of out planting and creating.
Yes, and it's kind of like they don't have a dishwasher, and all the kids are sort of like chopping things and sort of going in and out, and they write all their phone messages in crayon on the unpainted walls, and it's just I would live with that family. I would have sex with every member of that family in that book. That's the thing.
I think she does, doesn't she?
She has two of the three men plus their childhood friend. So she really gets around in that book, but you can see why, because it's such a sensorial sort of, everyone's always talking about each other's genitals all the time in a way you just don't get in big house English books.
Well, can you remember the first sexy book you read where you had an inkling of this idea that, you know, you thought, there's something going on here that I've never encountered before and that I might get into trouble if somebody caught me reading this.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So the original isn't here, but the sequel is here.
Ooh.
So The Flowers in the Attic.
This God, Virginia Andrews.
So yes. Well thumbed. You can see the spine has been broken.
That is a
like it's been on a rack.
Shattered spine.
So that's a sequel. That's Petals on the Wind, which has even more sex than the first.
These covers used to terrify me. I'm sure they've been reissued since, but I'm just going to create an oral picture. Black cover. A very stylized rose shedding its petals with sexy incest twins as a sort of an inset picture with chrome lettering. This must have cost a lot of money to do this in 1980.
Yeah, and I remember the original Flowers in the Attic, it had sort of the house and the windowsill, and then in the insert was the family.
God, the brother and sister, and that they both look like they're about 47.
I know, and they're supposed to be like 16 and
really
20.
Really aged them.
It ages people. So for those who don't know, the Flowers in the Attic series was this series about this four kids who are stuck in the attic of a old mansion called Foxworth Hall, and their mother has put them up there because she has to try and win her inheritance back off her dying father, and he can never know that she had children. And so they're up there for 3 or 4 years, and it's like through these, like, you know, the key developmental stages. So I think they're 14, 16, and then there's two young twins who are about 6 going into the attic, but they're there for about 4 years, so they sort of sexually develop and they end up in this sort of incestuous relationship that plagues them their whole life. And throughout these several books they try and escape this pull they have on each other, but they can't because they've been so, you know, neglected
like
and abused.
But
like you and Sylvie here, who keeps trying to shag your leg, I'm very sorry. But I read Flowers in the Attic when I was about 12, and I think it was the first time I ever came across.
Did it come into your life? Did someone give it to you?
My sister, I never forget it. My sister's 10 years older than me, so she came in with it with like hidden behind her back, and then she presented like she had smuggled it in from like a pirate ship, and then she like just produced it, and she was just like, you need to read this. And you know when your sister tells you to read anything, you're a bit like, go away, you don't know me. And then I started reading it, and it was just the most compelling thing ever. And I don't think it was the first time I'd ever seen sex in a book, but it was the first time I'd ever had like the wrong, dark, horrible love affair that should never exist and should never even be spoken or thought about.
Where because sex is the book, and it is so clearly wrong sex.
Oh, so unbelievably wrong. But and it was one of those moments where it's like, I can't believe people are legally allowed to write about this.
Well,
you know,
in a weird way, because I read My Sweet Audrina first.
Did you? I've not read that one.
Oh, it's basically the same. It's to do a massive spoiler. The heroine, Audrina, is raped as a child and rather get a therapy. They just pretend that it's her non-existent elder sister who was tragically murdered and that she's got to live up to her legacy. And they do it by wiping her memory and holding seances and not having any crooks in the house. And
always
great. It is amazing.
I love that shit.
And it's one of those books where like everybody's mum is their sister and everybody's uncle is their dad. Oh. You know, in Love Island, when Danny Dyer, her granddad is granddad bruv because she wanted a brother when she was little and she didn't have one. So her granddad's like, I'll be your brother. So it's granddad bruv.
That's so cute.
And it's cute. But that's the My Sweet Audrina is a creepy literal version.
But like, that's Virginia Andrews, V.C. Andrews. Mm. That was her whole deal. Like, and her whole deal was like she was this woman. She was wheelchair bound and she lived with her mother. And there was journalists, like very, very rarely would she allow journalists to interview her, and she would always feed them powdered sugar donuts. And that's how one of the kids in her books dies, by eating poisoned donuts. So she had a real sense of her own mythology, you know?
So it sounds quite Grey Gardens-y.
Yeah, no, it was very that, very, very that.
But I do remember with that reading, being sort of stunned, because I'd read a lot of books that were beautifully written and being very, very glad to read them, but that you were kind of allowed to issue literary merit for telling this creepy compulsive story. Right. And I think I got quite giddy, like a contact high, on the fact that it wasn't elegant and
so
structured
strange.
And plotted in a way that
so it was like,
everything
open,
else
open
I knew
that
was.
Book on any page and read out a sentence, because it's the most clunky, strange, it feels like badly translated from another language, except it's written in English.
I hated the spiteful witch now. Really detested her. What's he done that was so terrible? Julia drowned his 3-year-old son. There's nothing on earth that would make me take the life of my child. I don't need revenge that much. I agree, she said, back to the mild tone now.
I agree. I too would not kill my son to have vengeance on my... And do you know what? That scene you just read, I think Flowers in the Attic could actually be my mastermind subject. That scene you just read is from the smallest subplot of like somebody murdering their own son, and it's like a tiny subplot. It's present for a single chapter. There's so much drama and kid killing in these books. It's insane.
When you wrote your book, were you thinking about this sort of thing and how freeing it was? Because obviously there are lots of plots and things that kind of come in, they don't go anywhere. And did you feel like, I must write this perfect, taut, beautiful, brilliantly crafted book, which, you know, for the record, I'm gonna lick your ass, I think yours is.
Shut up.
Or did you, was the fear of not doing it bigger than the fear of it not being perfect?
Oh, that's such a... Yeah, I think fear is a really interesting word to use about writing fiction, isn't it? Because especially, like, fiction is the kind of reading that most people fall in love with first, right? No one starts with, like, a historical biography of the Romanovs, do they? You know, they start with...
Business skills for dummies.
Business secrets of the pharaohs. So everyone starts with novels, don't they? And so, like, they have such an esteemed place. And I feel like everyone falls in love with that medium first who loves books. And, and to eat, there's such a narcissism with even admitting that you're trying to write a book. And it was very scary. And I think as well, and this is like the advice I always give to people who ask me, you know, how to write and finish a novel, because I think that's what people struggle with, getting past that kind of first 10,000 words. And I said, it's just like, tell people that you're writing a novel. And like when your friend says, like, are you coming to my birthday party? Say, I can't because I'm doing my novel. And don't tell her what it's about, but tell her that you're doing it, because you make a verbal contract with these people every time. You don't go to their thing so that you can do your thing. You're like, okay, well, shit, I've basically promised I've got to do this now. I can't not do it. There are a lot of plot strands in my book that don't go anywhere, that I just sort of like add for atmosphere or for vibe.
And... But the other thing is, one forgets. I said very grandly, one forgets. that's life, isn't it?
It's life! Not
life is just
up.
A load of plot strands that mostly don't go anywhere.
Right? Like the amount of people who you're in your life, you're like, well, I thought there was a vibe there, but I guess not. yeah, and there is kind of like, you know, sort of a witchy kind of character, and there's sort of like allusions towards magical realism, and you never quite find out whether or not that exists. And I think that, do you know what, actually, this is so silly, but I was watching Gladiator the other day, and I love Gladiator. Do you love Gladiator? The Russell Crowe film?
I like the 90s one with Wolf and the foam pugil sticks.
Everyone has their own Gladiator.
I'm familiar.
But, oh God, my hairband's fallen off. But what I love about that film is that, like, I mean, the plot is fine, but, like, there's this real, they hint to a lot of the world. You know, there's this whole sort of, like, thing with Joaquin Phoenix's character and his sister, and they're sort of hinting towards an incestuous relationship. God, I'm back in incest again. But I love incest. I fancy both my brothers. But it's never quite clarified. There's definitely a history there. There's also hinted at that maybe this woman's son is Russell Crowe's son, but we never quite get the full story. And we get the sense that everybody has a pre-existing relationship or has a vibe going on, but we never have to learn exactly what it was. And I love when books give you that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, of like...
Kind of the opposite of... Virginia Andrews.
Yeah, actually it is, like, yeah.
Oh no, I hate you because you killed my son.
I love when you just feel like you're just dropping in on this world that existed long before you and will exist long after you.
I just spotted a sexy book that one of our other subjects has as well. And it's interesting to notice what keeps coming up on people's shelves. It's How to Save Your Own Life by Erica Jong.
I love that book.
That is a fabulous cover. And it must have... Is that a first edition? I'm going to put Virginia on the table.
I don't know.
Because it says the new best-selling novel by the author of Fear of Flying. So this must be an original paperback, I'm guessing. Oh, wow. And who... Lots of these books, Caroline, have other people's names and addresses in. There's a number at the top.
Oh my God, who is it?
It's a number. This is Lombard Street.
I don't know why. It's got two addresses. I don't know why that's there.
It's Lombard Street address. And then there's a different one that's 14 the William Bly, which might be a pub, I'm guessing.
So I have listened to your podcast a lot and I noticed that almost all of your guests... are all about sort of not, you know, not turning down the pages and not writing in the books. I basically read my books with my feet. Like, I am the worst book owner ever. And I will often, if I'm on the phone, actually, that is my handwriting at the front. I've just realised. It is, yeah. When I'm on the phone, I'm just like looking for a piece of something to jot down.
So is this like a notepad?
Yeah, basically a notepad.
I assume these were people from the 70s. But these are just giving out the personal details of people you've been corresponding with.
I think I must have been on the phone and I had a meeting somewhere and I needed a notepad and I just would scroll it on the front. And that is how much respect I have for literature.
I've got to describe the sexy cover. Okay. Because the font has kind of got a... I don't know, what's the word? There must be a proper word for this font. There must be a name that's not like Boogie Nights font. It's not quite that stripy, but it's slightly groovy. And it's sort of half a very eyelashed, heavily made up face. And kind of, you can see like an open mouth. Looks like she's snogging herself in a mirror.
It does. It's very like, you can almost hear her saying, shit. I love Erica Jong. I think she's fantastic. And you know what? I had a bit of an existential crisis when I read that book, because I think I read it like maybe a year and a half ago. I found it in my parents' parents have a caravan in Kerry and it was just there next to their bed, tellingly.
Right.
And there's some very interesting just descriptions of sex. But she writes about women's lives and how they feel about their partners in a way that when you're a woman, when you're a young woman and you first start writing about your life and you kind of think like, wow, no one's ever written about the female life like this before. And then you realise there was this whole slew of women in the 70s who were writing about like sex and the pill and whether or not they're going to blow their husband and like all this like really detailed, nuanced, dirty, like complicated stuff. And you're like, oh, my generation thought we were the first and I guess we weren't.
I think what I loved about this book is that she really doesn't like her husband and she's... allowed to say that, and also they seem as terrible as each other.
Oh, they're awful. They're truly awful. And her, like, her, the way she observes sex with other people, like, there's this point
I
where
like
she's
Rosanna, the lesbian millionaire who wears a lot of musk.
Oh my God, I love those lesbian scenes. Were fantastic. Right, there was something. She says this brilliant line. She says something like, "It felt more cultural than physical." What does that mean?
Tried it once, didn't like it.
Yeah, it felt more cultural than physical. Like, wow, what the hell?
I think it's interesting, though. I don't know if sex in books is more or less politicised than it was in the 70s. Mm. And whether there are people... You know, when I think about how Erica Jong is a sort of real feminist pioneer and then the contempt that the sexy writers of today are held in, it doesn't seem
it's
fair.
It's interesting, isn't it? Well, I suppose the 70s, the tradition of feminism, the whole mantra was the personal is the political. Mm. So then, and we often have that with the sort of online, you know, I work for The Pool and so do you, and the sort of online sphere of feminism that like to even speak about these things is political in itself. Mm. And I think women in the 70s, they truly, really took that to heart. And I feel like Erica Jong did feel like she was doing something socially important by describing a man going down on her. And I agree with her, you know, and I wish we could buy back some of that credibility.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, sex writing is really difficult. Like, even if it seems operatic and strange when you're reading it and you're like, oh, who on earth has sex like this? Well, no one. But, you know, people don't act the way they do in books either. That's why they're books and, you know.
At school, when I did drama, I wasn't good, but a lot of it was in the exams. I conveyed surprise by raising my hands to my face and widening my mouth. Yeah, and so forth. And I think sometimes writing sex is a bit like that, and you can get quite caught up in the, well, would this work physically? You're there kind of at a desk trying to put your elbow behind your neck and like lift your leg up. Is this real? Is this a thing?
Writing a genuinely sexy scene is the hardest thing in the world. Literally. There's a scene in my book, Promising Women, that I wanted to write something that was like not like, because they have quite a, can be quite a tumultuous sexual relationship. It can be quite, it's violent in places.
There are definitely bits with Clem and Jane. Jane is our protagonist. Our protagonist, Caroline's protagonist. I can't have
our
her.
Protagonist.
And Clem is the, I don't know how would you describe, the main one, but he's...
Yeah, he's the focus, the main focus.
They have a relationship and he is the focus of that. And it's a toxic relationship in all sorts of ways. But definitely bits where I think, this is really hot, but I'm troubled by myself for thinking that.
Yeah, there's this bit where, and I found it quite, I had to sort of like get up from my computer and sort of like splash cold water face for the bit where they're in a bed somewhere and he pins her arms down and he's found her lipstick on the ground somewhere and he puts it in his mouth and he starts drawing on her with the lipstick and it's sort of like that mix between sort of giggly and like this is quite forceful and dominant and quite strange, you know. And I think finding those like strange, weird, oh, I can see how this would be sexy sort of moments are, I love coming up with them, you know.
Because you do, because the details so good and that's what you need to make it leap off the page and translate.
Yeah, it's the silly things that people actually do in bed as opposed to just like, and then he grabbed my breast. I mean, there's so much nipple sucking in books,
oh,
isn't
there? Oh, you shapely mounds, he moaned.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We'll be back to Caroline soon, but now I want to tell you about my steal of the week, a book I loved so much that it felt wrong just paying the cover price and not telling the shop to stick another couple of zeros on the end. This week, it's the poet Patricia Lockwood's memoir, Priest Daddy, which was published by Allen Lane in 2017. This is the story of Patricia's relationship with her family and her partner, and how it was defined by her prog rock loving, trouser hating father's decision to become a Catholic priest, despite having five children. Lockwood is one of the few writers who can create a breathtakingly beautiful joke. She bends language to her will as if she had a blowtorch and a soldering iron. It's tender, honest, and every single page contains at least one heartbreaking sentence and at least five hilarious ones. Lockwood's voice is like no other. I utterly bloody adored this. Now back to Caroline. Are there any books here or books you've come across that have memorably awful sex scenes? We have to stop talking about sex. What's wrong with me?
Yes. Ooh. Oh my goodness. So, Louise Mensch. I've read Louise Mensch, but I've not read that one. This is Career Game. It's a sequel to Career Girls. And Louise Mensch, she used to be Louise Bagshaw. And when she was Louise Bagshaw, she wrote the filthiest, most compelling books I have ever read.
Career Girls, is that the one where one of them's a scriptwriter? And there are two women. One of them is the editor of the show.
Music Magazine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's when, because she was going out with the Metallica manager. In real life?
Okay.
Is that right?
So the deal with... And I'm actually... I'm doing an episode on Louise Mensch for Sentimental Garbage. So essentially, the Career Girls saga is about these two women who meet in Oxford. One of them is sort of a, you know, child of privilege, you know, hundreds of years of aristocrats.
Like, she's an American.
Yes. She's from Jersey. her name is Topaz. And she's like an Italian-American scholarship kid. And basically, they get into a war over who sleeps with whose boyfriend that lasts their entire life. Topaz goes on to like be the head of essentially like Hearst magazines. Rowena, the other one, becomes like this big music manager, and they sort of like destroy other people's lives in this kind of...
Rowena!
Yes, Rowena Krebs! And they destroy each other's lives in the sort of quest for vengeance. And they just are always having... They're never having fun and they have no friends, but they're always having the most upsetting sex.
Oh, but I have such a boner though for those in Bonkbusters, and it's so good in Lace as well, when like women doing business, and they're always like... They really do. It's so...
they just look amazing
and they're, you know, it's... they're always...
I love it.
Crystal Carrington in a boardroom with earrings doing takeovers, and I think Judy Kranz does that a bit as well, and I'm sorry, it's better than the actual sex scenes with like the stormen, and it's always completely ludicrous, like $10 billion on the table.
What I love about Louise Mensch as well is that she writes these like these characters who are like, she's the best in the business and the sexiest legs kind of thing. And it's like, she's like, and Topaz stormed in there and she said, here's how I'm gonna save you $2 million. And then it's like, and then she laid out her plan, because Louise Mensch can't think of a plan. She's just like, then she laid out the plan.
And then she used her business skills, which were as good, if not even better, than her sexual skills, which I can report about.
It is literally exactly that. It's the most fun you will ever have reading the biggest amount of trash, and I love it. Oh my god, I literally opened a random page. Okay, this isn't an outward sex scene, but it's a kind of a nice... Jo stiffened. She made herself sound like a reward, like a toy, like a slave girl handed to Caesar as some sort of booty. God damn, he hadn't had sex in a week, maybe more, and she was throwing herself at him with that soft skin, those limpid eyes, and those ferocious, unstoppable curves. He couldn't deny it. He would just love to see what those curves looked like naked in real life.
Oh my god, that's magnificent.
Oh, I love it. Oh, I could inhale these things one after another like candy floss. And the thing is, it's easy to make fun of when your pals are over and you're like, haha, isn't this ridiculous? But when you're in the heat of the moment of reading it, you're like, I'm a bit excited now, actually.
For sure. On this, let me see what else I... Yes, oh, why? Someone chewed your copy of Hotel Dulac.
Or some dog.
Oh, is the offender right here?
The offender is right here licking my hand.
Had you read it before it got eaten?
No, I hadn't.
You're on page 66.
And you know what? This is Anita Bruckner's Hotel Dulac, and I thought it was bollocks. And I was so mad at the dog for chewing it, and then I actually went on reading it, and I was like, do you know what? This isn't great. I think Anita Bruckner is so boring.
So you think that Sylvie did you a favour?
I think she's very discerning, actually. That. Although it is a beautiful edition, and I'm very annoyed because it's quite expensive.
Is this a first edition?
I think it's second or third.
It's a hardback, and it's got the dust jacket, and...
Yeah, I found it in... I live in Southeast London, and I got it from the Blackheath bookshop, which is fabulous. I also got that beautiful Muriel Spark, Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which I'm very proud of, over there.
Wow,
it's gorgeous, gorgeous
stunning
book.
Is that a folio?
It is, yeah. I got the two of them together for about £15.
Damn.
I know.
I'm looking at this really beautiful, beautiful Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. Oh, gosh, and illustrations by Beryl Cook. Had you... when did you first read Muriel Spark?
This was the first one I had read. And it was just because I'd always heard the Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, you know, as sort of the Maggie Smith film. I kind of dimly remembered it. And I was like, okay, fine. But I always thought Muriel Spark was going to be kind of like an Anita Bruckner in the sense that just sort of an important lady novelist. And I just thought, I started reading that book and then I stopped. Got a pencil because you have to read Muriel Spark with a pencil under every line.
You have. Brilliantly, and it's one of the best and most known, I think, bits in this with them. Can you do a Scottish accent?
I can't. Oh, no, not at all. Not at all.
Do you want to read this? Your annotation is such a fabulous bitch.
For those who like that sort of thing, said Miss Brodie in her best Edinburgh voice, that is the sort of thing they like. And just, Miss Jean Brodie just sort of this fascist sympathising woman who just believes that girls should only be educated to appreciate beauty and art, and that maths is a waste of time, that sports is a waste of time. And I just loved it, that there's a joke on every single sentence.
I love this idea that she's got these young girls, women in her care, and she assigns them all a personality, a bit like being in the Spice Girls, and that the Top of the Pops gen is saying, you're sporty, you're ginger, and how they all evolve and grow up to become people who absolutely thwart those labels, but they still remain a bit kind of frozen by how she has cast them.
Oh God, you're so good at reading. Such a good insight. Yeah, you have like, what is it? Sandra is the main character?
Sandra. Is she the one who becomes a nun? Spoiler.
Yes, spoiler, is that she has an affair with the kind of art teacher or something to that effect.
Even though there's a different girl who's supposed to be famous for sex.
Yes, Rosie is famous for sex. And then Sandra goes on to write a book about religion, and people come to her cell because everyone loves to visit a nun in a cell, as Spark says at some point. And they say to her, who are your influences? Who did you read? And then The final line of the book, and I love this, is she says, well, there was once a Miss Jean Brodie in her prime. And that just fills me and feeds me in a way that it's like, I don't know, for some reason, I don't know why that destroys me, but it does, you know, that this kind of owly little woman who had all these mad ideas about life and about girls, about what women should be, could cast such an indelible die on these women, you know, it kills me.
The world will take you at your own estimation if you present yourself as a person of influence.
That's exactly it.
I can see you've got a book that I absolutely loved here. Oh my God, what a complete Aisling. By
Emer McGlycett and Sarah Breen.
Oh, thank you.
They're the most fabulous girls in the world. And what I love about the Aisling series, there's two books now, and I love them both, is that they capture something about Irish modern womanhood that nobody else has tried to capture before, which is sort of that very specific kind of being an Irish basic bitch. And I love that. And I feel like they really push the envelope on what we expect from Irish women novelists. And I feel
I don't know if you know this, but I love it. I think my friend Jude, the one who told me this, that it was born out of a Facebook page.
And it was born out of
a conversation. It's like, who would wear brown mascara?
Yes! Who's keeping brown mascara alive? That's how it began.
Who is brown mascara for?
But when I was in college and uni in Ireland, I was a follower of that Facebook group, and me and my housemates used to howl laughing at it. And I couldn't believe when it became a book. And I also found out that Sarah Breen, she used to edit Ireland's only teen mag, which was called Kiss Magazine. And my first ever thing that I'd published was a letter to the editor, that one star letter.
Oh my God!
And Sarah had picked it. And now she's like a buddy, which is
mad. Did you win a prize?
I won a bag of Rimmel makeup.
Oh my God. I know. Bet you were just like, yes.
It was the first time in my whole life that I'd, because I talk about this a lot with people, because I entered so many like short story essays competitions, and I never ever heard back, and I always thought, well, I mustn't be a real writer. But I heard back from Kiss Magazine, my favourite magazine.
And you won.
And I won.
A gift of makeup, which is still all I ever really want to get. If someone was to ring me up now and say, you won a competition, have a bag of makeup, I'd be over the moon.
And to go full circle on the whole thing, I believe the lipstick in there was brown.
Ooh. Well, was it the 90s?
I think it would have been 2002.
Yeah, that would have been brown, for sure.
Oh, it would have been brown.
What was the letter about?
The letter was about mobile phones and how all the girls in my classes wanted mobile phones, but I was very deliberately not getting one because I thought that much communication between people was bad for them.
And to this day, you have no phone, right?
And to this day, I have no phone and no social media. untrue.
Was that one of the things that did first make you think, I can do this?
Yeah, it was completely. It was so important because I always feel very left out of other writers' conversations because I find almost everyone I know who publishes books, they were like very clever clogs in school, or they did very well in school, and I always did really, really badly, and I always thought I was really stupid, and I always got D's and F's. And even in English, I was good at writing stories, but I couldn't ever quite answer the questions in the right way, and I could never quite handle it, or I don't know what was going wrong, but I always felt very stupid. And I always thought that like journalism and writing was for smart people, and like it was like little things like that that made me feel like, oh, maybe it isn't just for clever people, you know?
That's so interesting because I should say that me and Caroline are friends. I just, and in knowing you, I just assumed you'd be one of those, you know, naturally smart people.
Thank you so much for assuming that. But no, very much not. I felt very dense for a lot of my life.
So thank you to Kiss Magazine.
Thank you, Kiss Magazine.
Starting Caroline on a path.
Thank you, Sarah.
I've just spied Elvis in Me by Priscilla Presley. I think we might have this book.
Yes.
These pictures are amazing. How did this come into your life?
So I went to Graceland a couple of years ago. I went on a tour of the southern states, and we ended it in Graceland, and I really have a big soft spot for Elvis Presley in my life.
Oh my god, she's so beautiful, isn't she? She's just like, look at her mascara, she looks like, you know those pictures of like Morgan Fairchild from infomercials in the early 90s?
Oh yes,
it's a very
yes.
In the nicest
kind
way
of peachy 70s 80s yes. glow that people have.
It's very Vaseline on the lens, but I think that's yes. probably her real skin.
I think so too. So I came to this book because me and my boyfriend, we went on a 3-week trip of the American southern states, beginning in Atlanta, looping around Louisiana, flying to Texas, and then finally ending up in Memphis, where I spent my last $100 going to see Graceland. And I've got a real like soft spot for Elvis. It's like the music I listened to growing up. My dad was huge into him, and that's the first kind of songs I remember. But you know, I was going around the Graceland, and have you ever been?
I've never been to Graceland.
It's an incredibly moving experience going to Graceland, especially if you've grown up with him. And because it's weird because it shouldn't be moving, because you're going around and it's like you have your little iPad thing that's connected to the speakers, and it's like you go into every room and it's narrated by John Stamos, and he's like, here you will see the jungle room, and like and the staff, which is like every teenager in Memphis is employed there, and they're like, yeah, just listen to John Stamos and come into the next room, and it's like okay. But for some reason, what's really funny about being in Graceland is that when you're European, you're used to going into like, you know, oh, this stately home where you could, here's all the framed cutlery and here's all that. And we're used to history being quite there all the time because America is comparatively quite young. They have to make a lot out of a little. So that the fact that you're being guided through this house like it's a museum and everything's from the 70s is a really weird feeling. And you almost feel like history kind of running up to catch you. And then it ends at Elvis's grave. And it's just, I don't know, for some reason, it's a really emotional thing. And everyone ends up in tears. I was just weeping on Elvis's grave in the back garden.
I guess it's a whole life, isn't it?
Yeah, you go through the whole... Through. Yeah, you do go through the whole life because you go through his costumes, his awards, his TVs. And they do sort of arrange it chronologically. And it's like, well, here's the front room where he would entertain his family. But then you end up in the basement where actually he spent most of his time. He was quite sad and he had a substance abuse problem and... You know, it is a very emotional thing. He's not, definitely not a perfect person at all. Like, I mean, he became her boyfriend when she was 13 and he was like 20.
Could we forget, don't we? Just how
abducted her, you know? She was living in Germany with her parents. And he was like, you should come finish school in Memphis, live in Graceland. We won't have sex. You can live under my parents' stewardship. And he eventually like deflowered her at 16.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's a intense book.
It's very, very troubling to think of him seeing a child essentially going, "Oh, that one."
I know, it's very. I don't know. I don't know how to parse that either.
I don't want to end on Elvis as sort of
death.
Death and sadness and creepiness.
So there's a lot
Tell
of witch books here.
About your magical books. Occult, witchcraft and magic.
So this is a fantastic... I'll take you through all of them. A brief history of magic over here. So here is the occult, witchcraft and magic, which is a really, really good overview of sort of European magical traditions. Then over here is the witches, which is a brilliant history of the Salem witch trials. Really properly good book, and I generally hate biographies. Then I've got my fiction, like I've got the witches of Eastwick here. here, and I have Practical Magic over there. And then I have all my tarot collection here. So these are some of the decks. Yeah, so that's...
So these are beautiful. There's a real collection. How are they? Yeah. Do you use them together or for different times?
Different times for different moods. For different people sometimes. I mean, it sounds very woo-woo, but some people... Like, for example, this one is the Aquarian Tarot, and that is based on Art Deco illustration.
Oh, this is beautiful. Where did you get this?
I just pick them up whenever I go. I actually streamlined recently. I do give some of them away as I go. And there's more in there and in my bedroom. But whenever I go traveling somewhere, I try and pick up something. That's quite a common one. This one is Wiccan.
Oh, wow.
This one is Chinese.
Kind of. It's in a pink gauzy bag, and there are some beautiful leaves and tendrils in the back, and I see a...
Yeah. It's actually... What's cool about it is... So this is a Chinese one. This is a Mexican one. The Game of Thrones one up there.
Wow.
And what's really fun is, like, do you know how with the Rosetta Stone, it's like, you know, okay, if you know one of these languages, then you could decipher the other languages, yeah, kind of thing. And that's the sort of idea. It's kind of the same with tarot. If you know the meaning of one card, or all of the cards, then you can, when you look at the same card in the Chinese deck, you see how the Chinese interpret that theme. So you're like, oh, okay, hope is represented by this certain bird or this certain flower. And you end up getting these, like, very interesting cultural understanding of other cultures that you wouldn't know about otherwise. So I'm a massive, massive tarot fan. There's quite a few guides here as well. There's Jessica Crispin's The Creative Tarot. There's Michelle T's Modern Tarot, which is the best book if you want to learn tarot yourself at home.
How much are you allowed to tell us about your next novel, and when is that out?
Oh, well, so I actually have two books in the work right now.
Ooh, that's very exciting.
So my next novel, the working title is Homebodies. It's about this girl who is a second generation Irish. Her father's Irish. She's from Essex. She's a filmmaker who is making this film about her father's early life, which is marred by this big kind of Aberfan-esque tragedy that happened in Ireland. And then she is sent back there because she's going to a film festival and ends up in his old town, where everything is not quite as it seems, and it becomes quite a Scooby-Doo mystery. So I'm sort of in the final stages of that at the moment. It's probably coming out 2020, I imagine. And then I have another book that I'm working on that is about tarot. And it's a sort of essay book about, it's not so much a guide as it is about kind of what I just told you about, like, you know, what different signs and symbols means and how they relate to women and all that kind of thing. I haven't got it quite figured out, but they've given me money, so I have to write it.
Fantastic. I'm really, really excited that you're writing about it.
I hope so too. I mean,
many questions, but they will be answered by the book.
I love it. It's a big hobby of mine, and there are lots of other people who could probably been doing it for years more than I could, who could do more things, but I just think that it's more of a universal hobby than people give it credit for. Okay, so we're in the hallway now. There's Diana Mosley down there. Which I believe you gave me that book. Diana Mosley, another very controversial character. I think you did. Diana Mosley, Nae Mitford. And that is a book of her collected journalism. I'm pretty sure you gave it to me.
The Pursuit of Laughter. Yes, I had two of those. Is that the letters between them?
No, that's not the letters, which I also love. This is Diana's, who was the third. So it was Nancy, then Pam, then Diana. She was the third.
For some reason, I don't know why, I always think Diana's the eldest.
I know, because
she's quite, you know, once you don't go into the fascist years, she's got a kind of a Jane Bennett quality, I think.
She does. And, like, there's something very fascinating about Diana, because yes, she was married to Oswald Mosley, founder of the British Fascist Party, as they knew it then. And
I'm really sad, because hideous, when she's married to Brian Guinness,
you're right.
And they just have these lovely, lavish parties, and they seem to have these, like, insane parties every week that cost £1 million. Like, why would you go and fall in love with a terrible, terrible fascist and go to prison? Why not have the parties and the dresses and the froth and the nonsense? I like the froth and nonsense.
Well, I know, but it's the same. But what I love about Diana, not obviously there's so much to not like, but what I do like about it is that she was one of those posh people who just like, once she had made up her mind about something, she would never go back. She would never apologize. And the idea of a Mitford apologizing or explaining their behavior is insane. You know, they just, like Jessica Mitford, who's sort of the one that everyone loves, was the same. She just was all about the Communist Party, and she's did some dreadful things. She sold their mother's retirement island without telling her, out of spite. And I just think that they were so just like, well, this is what I'm doing, and if you don't like it, da, 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 da. And they just stuck to their guns to a fault, which makes them so compelling as sisters.
And to how they reconciled that with who they are, and that they're still very much a family and very much a unit, even when totally opposed.
Oh God, and you know those, the books, the book where the letters from six sisters, where you get to the end and it's just Diana and Debo left, and they're just, oh, it's just so heartbreaking as you see the letters between them start to peel off, you know, because they've, time has claimed them. And yeah, I find that book very affecting. I go back to it a lot.
I see some really very chunky books here. It's really enormous. I love how you've got David Foster Wallace and Jonathan Franzen hanging out together, being manly, getting their bro on.
There's two big bookcases. One of them belongs to my boyfriend Gavin, who is a designer, and they're mostly books about design. One of them is my books, which is mostly novels. And then this bookcase over here is Misc. We haven't quite decided who owns what. We haven't quite put them in things. Although there is one of my books here, which is Jermaine Greer's The Boy. Which is that. I bought this from that same bookshop where I bought Muriel Spark's book. Basically because it's absolutely bizarre.
I love how we've got three quarters of a nipple on the cover.
I know.
And on a boy.
So it's Jermaine Greer, no nutter, decided that true equality between the sexes means that women should be able to fantasize about preteen men the same way that men fantasize about preteen women, and that it was her right to objectify young boys. And it's just a book of nude boys.
I mean, lots of them, I should say, are
paintings and art. Yes, that's true.
It is legal for Caroline to own this book.
It is legal. It is not outright pornography. And do you know what? I don't agree with Jermaine Greer on lots and lots of things, but I sort of like, well, I guess you went and did it, bitch. I guess you really got this published. And it's something that just fascinates me about it, you know, that...
I don't know if you ever find this, but there's, you know, the chutzpah of
it. That's the word for it.
And sometimes books come out and you think, oh, I didn't know you're allowed to do a book on that. I would have had a go.
Yeah, look at all these willies.
So many. With also lots of... I guess it's the classical way, but I've seen a lot more ball sacks than willies.
Yes, they really were quite proud of ball sacks back then, weren't they? I wonder what that was about.
Maybe it's our modern diet and lifestyles that sort of shrunk them a bit, made them less prominent. It's mobile phones, Caroline.
Mobile phones. I was right in my kiss letter.
Huge thanks to Caroline. You can find her on social media at Zaraline. And find out where to read her writing and listen to her podcast there. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Tweet me at NotRollerGirl. Bust me for excessive book buying on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. And please do subscribe, rate and review us. It helps people find the podcast and we love hearing what you think. For a list of all the books mentioned in the show today, go to acast.com/booked. For any questions about the podcast, you can email whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. I'll see you next time for some more Pulp Friction.
Are you serious? Oh my God.
That's the sound of Lucy getting up. Random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be sending her entire family on a cruise to celebrate her parents' 45th anniversary. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you too with a great deal on a fuel-efficient Honda, like the 2024 CR-V Hybrid. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.